All right, so we're transitioning a bit to Rhizosphere Biogeochemistry and Plant Nutrition. Dr. Philippe Hinzinger has spent much of his 30-year career studying this topic, and he was trained in soil science and ag science. I'm going to try my high school French. L'École Nationale Supérieure Agronomique de Montpellier. Yeah, pretty close. And so he's very interested in improving nutrient use efficiency of crops by examining the processes that go on in the rhizosphere and the various root traits. So welcome. He's come a very long way. And again, thanks to the sponsors for helping us pay for the travel to get him over here.
Thanks a lot, Bill, and thanks to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here and present this topic, which is my favorite topic, as you've been mentioning, for many years now. Although I'm talking here about nutrient cycling in agroecosystems, it will be a lot about what's happening at the rhizosphere scale. And I will try sometimes to draw links with much bigger scales. First of all, I would like to acknowledge some of my co-authors. Han Erel is here. He was a postdoc recently in our group, and I will present a little bit of our common work. Also, I will show some work, recent work by a PhD student about what's happening not just in the topsoil, but also in the very deep subsoil. And I would like also to acknowledge other root and rhizosphere addicts in my groups of Frédéric Gérard, Jean-Paul Laclos, and Christophe Jourdan. Well, this is the definition I like. Well, that's pretty much the one provided by Iltner more than 100 years ago, as Larry was pointing previously. So the rhizosphere is a soil volume around living roots that is influenced by root activity. It's a very broad definition, pointing that this specific volume of the soil is really a hotspot for soil biophysics and soil biogeochemistry, on top of being a hotspot for biological, microbiological activities. Most often you cannot see it. I was lucky enough in this soil profile, pretty deep in the soil, under a eucalypt tree to see a difference in terms of color around this root. But in most cases, you don't see a difference from the naked eye. And then you need to use special tricks, such, for instance, the use of sensors, such as these optical sensors called optodes that can help us measure pH. I will show some more of this later on, but this is just to start up with, illustrating that the pH around this, on the left, around the root of eucalypt, is pretty much different from the bulk soil. Well, in a previous talk, Larry has been mentioning a lot Jonathan Lynch, who for me as well has been very inspirational, especially with this paper, The Roots of the Second Green Revolution. And it's quite recent that plant breeders have been bringing their attention to roots, and there was a paper in Nature relating pretty much on this former paper by Jonathan Lynch, where Jonathan was pointing that the Green Revolution was actually based on crops responsive to high soil fertility because of, well, the idea of improving the varieties together with mechanization, irrigation, fertilization, and pesticides. Well, he also pointed that then the second Green Revolution will be based on crops that would be tolerant to low soil fertility. So it's a major change of paradigm. And to do this, I mean, this means plants that are exhibiting improved nutrient acquisition efficiency through either or both foraging strategy or mining strategy. So these are the promising subterranean strategies that were mentioned in this paper in Nature. Most of what Larry has been mentioning before are more related to the foraging strategy, and in this talk I will mention a little bit about this, but focus a little bit more on my own work, which is more related to mining strategy. So basically what I mean here is foraging strategy is really meaning increasing the rhizosphere volume to have a better soil exploration, whereas mining strategy is increasing the availability of nutrients in the rhizosphere. And these two things are really important, as Larry was mentioning before. It's especially relevant for poorly mobile and poorly available nutrients, such as potassium, phosphorus. I will mostly concentrate on these two during this talk, but also for micronutrients, obviously, in many soils. So to start up with, I will concentrate first on consequences of this primary function of roots, which is the uptake of nutrients and water. And because of this has major dramatic impact on the availability of nutrients and hence on ecosystem services at a much broader scale related to nutrient cycling. And also, as I will point in some of my work, with soil formation. Larry was mentioning this. I mean, it has been shown quite a long time ago, in the 60s, using radioisotopes and autoradiography that we do have depletion of nutrients such as phosphorus or potassium around roots. And because of the poor mobility of these nutrients, this is occurring over rather short distances. So you can see on the left-hand side for phosphorus, for instance, that the size or the radius of the rhizosphere is just about 1 millimeter, and possibly several millimeters for potassium. So this is definitely a major constraint for phosphorus and potassium acquisition for plants. And this is the reason why foraging is a very important strategy. This is illustrated here with the same sort of approach as mentioned before, the shovelomics approach for maize. These are some of the similar lines as Larry was mentioning for nitrogen, his nitrogen work. In this work, we looked at traits that were explaining phosphorus acquisition in field-grown plants at flowering. And you can see here that we obtained quite a decent relation with the topsoil root surface area that was measured from this shovelomics approach, coupled with an analysis software that can quite easily extract quantitative information from these complex images. You see that there is indeed, across these two soil types, quite a good relationship between this trait and P acquisition. That means that foraging and increasing the surface area through a number of tricks, as mentioned by Larry, is definitely an important strategy for the plant for acquiring poorly mobile nutrients such as phosphorus or potassium. But most of the work we are doing and still do are mostly on topsoil roots, and we try to forget that roots are growing deeper than that, and this is among the champions. I know. In our group, we've been working for many years on eucalypt plantations, especially in Brazil, in Africa as well. And in Brazil, this was measured at one site where we have almost the biggest productivity on the planet, although the soils are very poor, but very deep. And in this very deep soil, this is the map of the fine root density. And you can see that after a year, you have pretty large densities down to 2 or 3 meters, or after 6 years, down to 4, 5, 6 meters, and you get quite a lot of roots still down to 10 meters or more. So that's quite fascinating how these plants are growing so many roots pretty deep in the soil. And probably if we just look at topsoil roots, we miss a pretty large part of the story. I don't know whether you can see it on the two pictures on the right-hand side, we even observed ectomycorrhizal tips down to several meters. And we are currently trying to identify the species involved. in this symbiosis very deep in the soil profile. So that's really challenging our knowledge of roots and root foraging, which is most often derived from young plants or from topsoil roots, whereas for many plants, not just for trees, this is also true for cereals and many other crops, a very substantial portion of the root system is in the subsoil. Well, on top of that, the depletion of nutrients that I've been mentioning before, and now I'll be moving away from the foraging strategy and to get into the mining strategy. Nutrient depletion, as in this case for potassium, can also provide access to poorly available pools of nutrients. In this case, non-exchangeable, so-called non-exchangeable interlayer potassium. So that's very old work. That's what I did in my PhD thesis 30 years ago, almost. And what I did basically was supply the plant with a single source of potassium that was non-exchangeable. That was a mica. And so you have here on the left-hand side the X-ray diffraction spectra for the control without plant, and after 2 days in the rhizosphere of ryegrass. No difference at this stage. But you see that rapidly after another day of growth, you see another peak appearing on the X-ray diffraction pattern for the rhizosphere. And after a month, there is a complete transformation of the mica into a clay mineral that is vermiculite. And this is clearly the indication of the capacity of a root to develop a mining strategy, in this case contributing to the weathering of a primary mineral into a clay mineral. In the same work, we try to represent the intensity of this weathering or the corresponding release of interlayer potassium as a function of soil potassium concentration, and we indeed showed that there was a threshold value, in this case about 80 micromoles per liter, below which this interlayer potassium release could occur, and therefore the major impact of the plant was to be able, at the level of the roots, to be able to decrease this potassium concentration below this threshold, and therefore thereby result in a considerable change of the mineralogy and considerable flux of potassium, additional potassium being supplied to the plant coming from the so-called non-available pool. Well, actually, this is what's happening at the rhizosphere scale, but if we look at much broader scale, the plot scale, over longer periods of time, for instance, looking at long-term fertilizer trial, we can relate these rhizosphere processes with these pretty large fluxes of release of non-exchangeable potassium that were ranging from several kilograms per hectare per year up to 100, almost 100 kilograms of potassium per hectare per year. And in any case, this can happen just because of this depletion, very intense depletion that is occurring around the roots. So that's an important process happening at a very small scale with a dramatic impact at the big scale of a plot or even catchment scale. I would like to come back to phosphorus now. And for phosphorus, I'm coming back to the work I mentioned before where we looked at a number of genotypes of maize. I mentioned before the foraging strategy, but we have also evidence that it's not just foraging, it's also combination with mining strategy. In this case, what I'm showing is for the two soil types that we studied, that in the rhizosphere, when looking at the available pea pool, contrary to what we were expecting, again, because of everything published on depletion of phosphorus in the rhizosphere, actually we didn't really find any significant depletion. We even observed for the alkaline soil a slight but significant increase of available P in the rhizosphere compared with the bulk soil. And this was also the case. That was on the left-hand side, it's for the low P soil, but that was also the case at high P level. So this is clearly showing that it's something not just about depletion, there is something else happening in the rhizosphere. Well, conventionally what we think is that roots are only able to tap into this available pool of nutrients, as for instance available P, and it's well known for phosphorus that the size of this pool is very small compared to the unavailable pool. But actually, many, many plants are capable of developing tricks, phosphorus mobilizing processes, a number of processes, that, as for instance, the exudation of carboxylates, or the secretion of phosphatase, or pH changes, that can increase the size of the available P pool at the expense of the unavailable P pool, and for the benefit of P uptake for the plant. So I'm going to illustrate this for pH change, for which I've been working a lot. But it's just one of the examples. There are many, many possible strategies behind this one. So I'm going to talk now for the last part of my talk about these pH changes occurring around the root in the rhizosphere that are actually pretty much related, again, with cation and anion uptake, actually, and that have also dramatic impact on nutrient cycling and soil formation on top of many other processes. One simple evidence that we came up with simple observation in the field is that, and that was, well, you can find this in very old books dating back from the 18th century, you can sometimes look at or identify imprints of roots left over limestone. This is limestone plates. This is a rock. And you see the imprints of the roots that are related to dissolution of calcium carbonate. Very clear indication of acidification of the rhizosphere. Other evidence are brought with the technique I mentioned before, using new techniques like optical sensors that are developing pretty fast these days. And these optodes here have been used for monitoring acidification occurring around roots of a legume. In this case, what you see, the little white dots correspond to the nodules, and you can see that there is clearly acidification occurring at much greater level close to these nodules compared to the other parts of the roots, and also that this acidification is greater in the day than at night. We also played with an interesting case because we think it's pretty interesting in the context of nutrient acquisition to understand the functioning of intercropping systems. So we did a rather simple experiment, growing together two very different species, a cereal, a durum wheat, and chickpea, a legume. And we used the sensor that we placed in this square area where we had roots of the two species crossing each other. So that's what we obtained using this sensor. And basically you see here that acidification is occurring around the chickpea root, whereas nothing much is happening around the wheat root. It's also interesting to look at what's happening over time. You see that with the appearance of these lateral roots of chickpea, there is clearly acidification occurring around them, and over time this is further merging with the primary root. In the end, there is a 2 pH unit difference within a few hours around the roots of chickpea compared with the bulk of the soil or with the rhizosphere of durum wheat. And 2, for many of you who are soil chemists or who have some background in terms of soil chemistry, you should know that 2 pH unit makes a lot of difference in terms of chemistry, in terms of availability of nutrients such as phosphorus. And therefore, we can come up with this sort of conceptual scheme to understand the functioning of these intercropping systems, where in this case, even if the wheat is not really changing the pH of the rhizosphere, If it's intercropped with another species, like a legume, like chickpea in this case, capable of changing the pH pretty much, what is going to happen in the rhizosphere, common rhizosphere of these two species, is that there will be an increase of the size of the available pea pool at the expense of unavailable pea, as a consequence of the phosphorus mobilizing process evolved by chickpea. And this is going to be beneficial for chickpea, but possibly beneficial for the germ wheat as well. This is what in ecology we call facilitation, and I called it at once P42. And this is an illustration of this, trying to link now pH in the rhizosphere with the availability of phosphorus in the rhizosphere. So basically on this diagram you can see that on the right hand side that for durum wheat, compared with the bulk soil, there was hardly any difference in terms of either pH or phosphorus availability. Whereas at the other hand of the diagram, on the left hand side for chickpea, there was a clear acidification, more than 2 pH units, and therefore a substantial increase of water extractable pea or available pea in the rhizosphere. Interestingly, for the rhizosphere, common rhizosphere of the durum wheat and chickpea roots in the intercropping systems, we were somewhere in between. And therefore, probably the durum wheat could benefit in this case of the available of this increase of available pea related to rhizosphere acidification induced by the chickpea. Well, before coming to my conclusion, I would like to come back to this story about deep roots and what we've been looking at in these eucalypt plantations in Brazil, in these very poor and but deep soils, oxysols. We've been recently measuring rhizosphere properties all along a fairly deep profile, not as deep as the roots are growing. They are going down to the water table, which is about 17 meters. We were not brave enough to get there, but we've been digging down to 4 meters. And interestingly, we've been finding, although the soil was pretty acidic, acidification occurring in the rhizosphere all over the profile. In the meantime, we also measured other properties, and one of those that showed the biggest changes was exchangeable potassium. And surprisingly, again, it was not what we were expecting in the first place. No depletion at all. You can see here that there is, in contrast with depletion, it's just the opposite. We observed a very significant increase of exchangeable potassium all over the profile, and especially at depth, where bulk soil exchangeable potassium was extremely low, but in the rhizosphere it was pretty much bigger. We think that, well, because we don't have a clue for any other potential explanation for this, that it's some evidence that weathering was going on, weathering of potassium-bearing silicates in this soil was going on, explaining such an increase of available potassium in the rhizosphere. Well, we've tried to relate again this exchangeable potassium with soil pH, because that's quite obvious. If weathering of silicates is involved, that it's a possibility that acidification would contribute to further increase these weathering rates. And for when plotting all the points along the soil profile for the bulk soil, there was quite a nice relationship between pH and exchangeable potassium. But however, when we plotted the points that the values that we obtained in the rhizosphere, it was clearly not as simple as that. So therefore, conclusion is that it's not just weathering of potassium silicates in the rhizosphere as a consequence of rhizosphere acidification. There must have been some other process contributing to this phenomenon on top of acidification of the rhizosphere to explain this substantial increase of exchangeable potassium that we've been observing in the rhizosphere. But that's telling us that we need definitely to further look at what's happening at depth and not just stick in the topsoil. So to conclude, There are a number indeed of promising subterranean strategies that roots are developing on the foraging site, root growth and development, root architecture, as Larry has been nicely pointing in his talk. On root anatomy, there has been beautiful work, and there is a beautiful work going on in Southampton with the group of Tina Roos on root hairs with the same sort of synchrotron-based technology and coupled with modeling that is currently being achieved. And so that's another very important trait for accessing to poorly mobile nutrients such as phosphorus. And obviously that's where mycorrhizal symbiosis comes into place. It's another very efficient way to increase the rhizosphere volume. Not just mycorrhiza, but also possibly PGPR bacteria involved in promotion of root growth. There is this other group of mining strategies. I've been mostly illustrating this with rhizosphere acidification, but there are a lot of work exploring exudation of organic compounds, especially carboxylates, phytosiderophores, for instance, for iron or zinc, and also a lot of work on the secretion of enzymes, a whole range of enzymes secreted either by the root themselves or by the microbes that are stimulated in the rhizosphere. So as pointed by in the review by Becker and the group of Vivanco a few years ago, we do have this possibility now to try to manipulate either those root traits we've been mentioning or the microbial communities, although it's probably easier to try to manipulate them through the genotypes that we are using or through soil management rather than directly manipulating the microbial communities. But definitely this is a very efficient way to go further into the direction of ecological intensification or sustainable intensification of agroecosystems. Before I get there, I don't know about the time. Okay. One thing I believe, and I also believe that modeling is a very interesting approach to further understand what's happening. I've been mentioning both foraging and mining strategies, and most plants are combining these two strategies, and therefore modeling is probably the only way to that we have for dealing with these complex things happening together. What we've been doing in this work is combine the same sort of models that has been mentioned by Larry. This is another one. This is ArchiSimple, developed by Loic Pagès, for modeling root architecture. So that's root surface density output from the model on the left-hand side. But we've been combining, coupling this model with MIN3P, which is a reactive transport model. So that's another model that is very powerful to take into account all the biogeochemistry that's happening in the rhizosphere. In this case, we are plotting pH change, but also based on this, we can compute the concentration of dissolved phosphorus in the rhizosphere. And that's certainly playing with these kind of models will help us trying to design novel ideotypes for the future. With this, I would like to thank you for your attention and remind you all that we shall not stick to the easy part, the topsoil, to the topsoil roots and to the younger roots. It's difficult to get deeper, but we need to get deeper. Thanks for your attention.